Welcome to Passionate Internet Voices Talk Radio, Inc., a League of Nations among other internet radio stations, Voices of the People United We Roar. Today is October 5th, 2007. PIVTR is the internet home for anyone seeking quality information and entertainment, as well as answers to many of the multiple concerns that the average person wants to know. At PIVTR, we not only promote experts passionate about their work, we offer you viable content and solutions. PIVTR is also dedicated to helping published mid-list and beginning writers, unknown authors, small businesses, and entrepreneurs to further market themselves, their services, books, and products to the media. And now, without further ado, let me present to you Martha Trowbridge and Happiness for Women Only. Good afternoon, Martha.
Good afternoon, Lillian. How are you?
I am doing fine, thank you.
Great. Well, welcome to all our listeners to Happiness for Women Only. This is Martha Trowbridge. Dr. Barbara is away today, though in spirit she certainly joins us. Our guest is eminent object relations theorist Dr. Frank Summers, author of three important books and numerous groundbreaking papers. Dr. Summers is supervising and training analyst at the Chicago Institute for Psychoanalysis and associate professor of psychiatry in the behavioral sciences at Northwestern University Medical School. Dr. Summers, welcome once again to Happiness for Women Only.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here again. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're so welcome. We're really privileged to have you. So, in our last interview, which for our listeners is archived as the August 3rd podcast, in our last interview we talked about your powerful metaphor, unworthy self, and how when we women suffer from feeling unworthy, even our best attempts at happiness often crumble. Before we explore another of your powerful metaphors, which today is defective self, please, once again for our listeners, define self.
Okay, self, as I define it, is our organized patterns of being and relating in the world, so that we all have different ways we relate to people and we relate to the world. There's patterns of relating and patterns of being. And we all have those, we learn those in childhood, and we develop a relatively stable way of relating to the world and other people. And that structure, the way we do that, is what I call the self.
Okay. So defective self, which is chapter 6 in your wonderful book, Transcending the Self, how does this happen developmentally, and what are the signs that a woman as an adult feels defective?
Okay. Well, those are two very good questions. The way I see it, and this is all based, of course, on my clinical work and on my reading and understanding of developmental research, that the child needs to have his or her affects responded to. That's well substantiated in the developmental literature.
Dr. Summers, could you please explain what an affect is for those
feelings
in our audience not
familiar?
Okay,
just the word we use in the field, in the clinical field, for feelings. You're born with certain feelings, enjoyment, interest, anger, sadness. Those are inborn feelings that we all have.
Yes.
And they're brought out by our early experiences. And so the child doesn't just feel something like happiness or sadness. It needs to feel it needs to have that feeling responded to. And when the child sees its affects mirrored, that is, responded to in a way where the object, the other person, responds with a similar kind of feeling, then it learns to feel that those feelings are real, that those really belong to me, I really feel this, and it's welcomed and accepted by the other person. That's the key thing. One of the great contributions of recent developmental research is that we now understand that feelings don't exist in a vacuum. They exist only in interpersonal environments, and unless that environment is conducive and receptive to those affects, they become walled off, they become disavowed in some way. You can actually see this on film. You can see a child trying to engage a parent, and when the parent is not responsive, the child will turn away, okay? And those affects tend to become buried, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so what the child needs basically is a responsiveness to those affective experiences, and in addition, help with negative affects. You know, we all have frustrations, anger, there's always going to be things in the child's life, and as in all our lives, that feel negatively. for the child, okay? They get frustrated, they get angry. And what they need then is somebody to help them with those feelings. They don't need to be left alone with those feelings, and they don't need somebody to take them away to come and protect them from ever feeling that. They need to be able to feel that and have a helper there who helps them learn to cope with it, to feel better, so that they learn that negative feelings can go away and that they can participate in that. That's the crucial thing. So that's in normal development. That's how we all learn to have positive affects and feel good about our ability to manage negative feelings, okay? But if those things don't occur, like in the example I gave of a mother turning away, okay, or of no help with there's crying and distress and there's nobody there to help.
Or, excuse me, if there's punishment when you cry or punishment when you express distress.
That's even worse. That's even worse. Yes, exactly. And, of course, that's what we see clinically all the time in many of our patients, even positive feelings. I mean, there are some families in which positive feelings are absolutely forbidden. So the child feels happy and excited, and that's met with a frown or a scowl or even punishment from the parents. And then, of course, the child feels what? They feel that they're bad for having the positive feelings.
And so how does that play out?
Okay, how it plays out is, and if they're negative feelings, also, by the way, they don't get help with the negative feelings, mm-hmm. they're left with a feeling of helplessness, that they cannot turn negative feelings around, that they can't do anything about them. So that leads to a feeling of helplessness. The positive feelings, if they're not responded to, they're punished, ignored, or negatively responded to in some way, the child then feels that there is something wrong with those feelings. So the way it plays out, and this is really the point I'm getting to in all of this, is the child learns not to trust their feelings. Their experiences, their spontaneous responses to the world, what we call their affects, their feelings, the way they would normally respond to other people, then they feel there is something wrong with that. Okay, there is something defective in them. They cannot rely on those feelings. And then they have to use defensive coping strategies to make their way through the world because the way they would spontaneously react, they feel is not good enough, is inadequate. And so then what we see in our adult patients, and I see this every day in my practice, is you'll see a woman who will come in and say, well, I don't know why, but I just don't feel good about myself. And inevitably, whatever the particular dynamics, and of course everybody is different and everybody's got a different situation, inevitably what we find is somebody who says that does not have any trust in their own spontaneous way of reacting. Okay? They are looking to other people to guide them and how they should be feeling or they should be reacting, to other people approve or not approve. And, of course, we all do that to some extent. We all want approval. But if you can't rely on your own feelings, if it always requires somebody else, then that becomes a problem because you feel who you are is defective, is not good enough. And then you need some coping strategy, which will be a defensive response to try to protect a feeling of inadequacy. The feeling of inadequacy, and I hope I'm making this clear, is the feeling that I cannot rely on what I feel, on who I spontaneously am.
Mm-hmm. Well, shall we talk a bit about Zelda from Chapter 6 of Transcending
sure,
the Self?
Sure. Be happy to talk about Zelda. The reason I started off that chapter on Zelda is because I think in so many ways she represents typical issues, certainly for a lot of women. Of course, a lot of people with this disorder we're talking about are women, but not all. You know, the defective self you see in a certain number of men also. But I'd say it's common in women, and Zelda kind of represents to me an almost prototypical kind of experience of that type. Because what happened with her in her particular situation is her mother was not available really to respond to her for whatever reasons of her own. She was focused on her brother and older sister. And her father had an absolutely volatile temper, okay, which terrorized everybody in the family. Mm. So what Zelda did is she was very pretty and always admired for her looks, but not for anything else. And so what she learned to do with her father was she learned to flirt with him and be coquettish with him and be disarming so that she was the only one, including her mother and two siblings, who never suffered his wrath. It was not visited upon her because when he would start to get angry, she knew ways of being coquettish and flirtatious that would disarm him. Mm-hmm. And so he would not explode at her, but he exploded at everyone else. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, that was a coping mechanism, and it was a good one because it allowed her to get by without experiencing these harsh judgments he meted out on everyone else. But on the other hand, what she felt was that what she could spend, who she spontaneously was inadequate. That if she responded with any kind of authenticity, with her anger at her father, or with any kind of genuine feeling, that she would be attacked for that, which she would have been. Okay? And that the way to get by in the world was to be a fake, to be coquettish, to be flirtatious, to disarm people. Okay? So she developed this facade of this kind of bimbo persona, okay, which worked in a lot of ways. It worked to gain the attraction of men, certainly. But underneath it, she absolutely hated herself because she knew it was all phony. And this is one of the things I've learned over 30-plus years now of clinical experience, is that the facades that people use that don't feel authentic, that don't feel like a genuine expression of who they are inevitably constructed to help them with a childhood situation that they had to cope with, but inevitably lead to a very self-destructive feeling inside because they know they're not being genuine, and they feel that who they are is not good enough. And the fact that they have to be fake to get by in the world always has its, let's say, its negative implications on the personality. It always makes people feel bad about who they are, okay? Because they know whatever they get is not really them. And that's why you get so many of these people, some of whom can be very accomplished intellectually or, in her case, for her looks or some with different talents, and they'll get an award or they'll get lots of compliments, and they'll always say, yeah, I got this award or this compliment, but it didn't mean anything to me. It never felt like me. And that's why, because the person getting the award, okay, didn't feel like who I am. It wasn't a genuine expression of me. I'm putting on a persona to relate to the world, and people are responding to the persona, but not to me. Actually, a great example of this from pop culture is Marilyn Monroe. That's exactly how she felt. She always felt like there was somebody right around her who was getting all these accolades and who was so adored by everyone, but it never felt like her. And that's exactly what happened to her, because this was a persona that she was putting on, and deep in her, inside her soul, she knew this was not what she really felt. This was not her. It was a game she was playing to get by. So it never worked, ultimately. It never gave her the good feelings that she was trying to achieve by it. And Zelda's very much that way. In many ways, Zelda's very much like Marilyn Monroe, or was, until she got into treatment.
So when Zelda did come to treatment, you mentioned, why don't you tell us a little, please, her life was in shambles, her marriage, she wanted to leave but was afraid to leave, and so on.
Right. She came in saying her life was exactly, almost those exact words, her life was a shambles. She said it was a mess. Her marriage, she felt, was complete fake, fraud. She felt like all she did was sleep and lie around depressed on the couch, and her husband completely took care of her. She hated herself for that, but she, of course, was absolutely terrified of leaving. She couldn't see any way out because she felt that she was completely dependent on this man. To whom she got married, she felt almost like an arranged marriage. It was somebody her parents approved of. On paper, he was just right for her. He was professional. He was successful. All these things that her parents wanted for her, but none of it felt genuine to her. It was not anything that had any interest to her. But she married him because she had such a defective sense of self. She did what other people expected her to do. She didn't feel like she could follow what she felt. If she had, she would never have gotten married to him. And the consequence was she was extremely depressed. She felt trapped into a marriage that gave her no gratification. She was working at a job part-time that she found very menial, and she was almost vitriolic in her hatred of herself, saying, I work at this job, it's completely menial. She had a college education, which she wasn't using, but she didn't feel the confidence in herself to do anything that was at all challenging, that would at all use her mind, because she felt all she had to offer was her looks. She regarded herself as an empty-headed bimbo. And as she started talking to me about herself, when we started reflecting on her past and her background, she would tell me things like that she had actually been bulimic as an adolescent and had been throwing up right in front of her parents, and her parents completely ignored this very serious eating disorder that she had. And then, of course, a vitriolic rage at her parents then came out about that, that how could they not notice? And she herself said, I realize now that as an adolescent, I was trying to communicate to them this way. This is my way of desperately trying to communicate that something was very much bothering me, but I didn't know it. And I found this to be extremely insightful, and I started realizing I was in the presence of somebody who actually had a great deal of insight, who had actually an intellect that was very useful to her, that actually enjoyed challenges, that she was interested in a lot of things and potentially interested in many others, but could not conceive of herself that way because she felt that all she had of any value was her looks, and she had always thought of herself as stupid. So I began talking to her about that rather than focusing so much on the marriage, which we did, of course, and how she got in and why she got into the marriage, because this was something her parents wanted for her, and we started talking about what did she want, what was inside her, what was important to her, what mattered to her. And surprising though it may seem, and this was a woman, I think, in her mid-20s at the time, she had never thought about it. It had never occurred to her that she could have an interest. And she would say, oh, I'm not interested in anything. And actually, that was not true. She was interested in health and physical health and mental health and in exercise and good eating habits and nutrition and things like that. But she never had codified it to herself as an interest. She never thought of it as an interest until I pointed out, actually, you do have a lot of interests. You're interested in your own motivations. You're interested in others. You're interested in healthy lifestyles. And she said she never thought of it as an interest. You see, because if you're a bimbo, you don't have interests. You
right,
just have your looks.
Yes, if you feel defective, how can you have an interest when you don't have the wherewithal to do anything about that interest? So
exactly.
You sort of just short circuit.
Right. And what she even said was interests are for other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not for me. And she would talk about how in high school, you know, she was, of course, very popular, being very pretty and coquettish. And she would hang out with the popular kids, and they would devalue anybody that had any interests or any goals in life as though they were above that kind of thing. But, of course, she realized in therapy what it really was is her feeling that she was so defective that she couldn't possibly have any interest. So that was a huge defense of devaluing others that she now saw as such a defense because she felt so defective about herself. And, of course, that was the source of her depression also.
Mm-hmm.
So the therapeutic process became one of painstakingly going over what did she really feel? What was inside Zelda? What did Zelda want? And codifying a variety of things. And I would say to her, this is an interest. This is a feeling you have. This is a belief you have. This is a value you have. Because she had never thought of any of those things as belonging to her.
So in her marriage, what was she seeking from her husband that she was not receiving?
Well, what she would have liked would have been, but she didn't know it, of course, was stimulation. Somebody who would be intellectually stimulating, emotionally stimulating, somebody who would help her think about herself, somebody who would form an emotional connection with her. But, of course, she didn't know any of that. But as we began talking about it, and she was talking to me about, actually, she'd had a couple of affairs, interestingly enough, with people who did not fit the model of her husband, but who actually were interested in her and would talk to her about what she felt. And it was clear that that's what she wanted from her husband. Go ahead.
Were the affairs while she was married or before?
Well, both. No, while she was married, even when she came to me. That was one of the reasons she actually came, she said, because she had this affair, and of course she felt very guilty about it. But this guy who she had the affair with, and it really wasn't that, I don't think sex was even a major part of it, or I'm not sure it was even any part of it, although she called it an affair. It was somebody she'd walk around with, go for walks with, who would stimulate her affectively and intellectually. They would talk about what they felt, talk about things that interested them. And so it became clear that she was emotionally, intellectually, in so many ways dead herself because so buried. And she had married somebody who was not going to bring her out of herself in any way, and that's really what she was seeking. The marriage was really all about her husband simply taking care of her financially and her being completely dependent. And
so it was, in a sense, a replica of her dynamics with her parents as a child.
Very much so. Very much so. It was very much a replica. It was her whole life really was a replica of that. That all I have to offer are my looks. It's the only thing I get recognized for. There's nothing in me that I have to offer anybody else. And the husband, of course, didn't demand that there be anything else. And she was sort of, in contemporary parlance, I guess you could say, a trophy wife in a certain sense, because she was there for her looks and admired for her looks and not for anything else. But what she didn't recognize was how enraged she was about that and how much self-hatred she had about that, because she really did long deep down inside her for to be recognized for her mind and for her feelings and for who she was and for her values and what mattered to her. But, of course, none of that could possibly have come out before she got into therapy and we started finding all the various feelings and interests and values that she had inside her. And this is what you get with somebody with a defective self. It's somebody who doesn't know that they really have a self. They feel defective because they've never used what they could potentially feel and value as guidelines for their own life. In a sense, they don't author their own life.
Right. Well, Dr. Summers, you say on page 177 of Transcending the Self, you say with such eloquence, and I quote, "Only in the recognizing gaze of the other can the child's potential become an organized self."
Mm-hmm.
End quote. As you well know, Heinz Kohut, the creator of self-psychology, realized that our lives are a continuum of mm-hmm. self-object experiences. That is, we continue all our lives through to require nurturing, affirming experiences with those in our relational world.
Mm-hmm.
So for us women, when our men do not provide that recognizing gaze, when instead we're ignored or belittled, contradicted, and worst, raged at, we're devastated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I do refer to Kohut in that very paragraph that you mentioned, and I also quote Winnicott, who says the following. This is just the next sentence after the one you read.
Mm-hmm.
"When the child looks into the mother's gaze, what she looks like is related to what she sees there." In other words, when the child looks in the mother's eyes, the child finds herself in the mother's eyes, okay? And so what the mother sees is going to be what the child takes in, is who they are. And what you're talking about is in a marriage or in a relationship, that we all look for the gaze in the eyes of the other to see who we are. And if you offer an idea, a feeling, a thought, whatever it might be, to your partner, who then denigrates you for that, okay, then what do you feel except what you could spontaneously offer is defective? It's not good enough, okay? And that's going to lead either to a complete burial of who you are or to an expression of rage if you're aware enough to be angry about it, right, or to some kind of defense to defend against your own feelings, like compliance, okay? Some women will then comply because they'll agree with the man, or at least unconsciously, there's something wrong with me because look at the response I got. So I must be wrong. You must be right. So then they submit and go along, okay?
Right.
And that would be a pattern that really was very familiar to Zelda, okay? And there's very few things that are more destructive to a human being than that, because what you're really doing is burying yourself. Okay?
Right.
And women will do that because they will assume, some women, will assume that the man knows better than they do, okay? And what neither partner knows how to do, really, the woman or the man, is how to negotiate otherness, how to negotiate difference, okay? The man has a right to disagree with the woman, right? A woman expresses what she feels or what she thinks or what her value is. Her partner, the man, the husband or boyfriend or whatever, may well disagree with that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. But in what we're talking about is a pathological situation where it isn't a disagreement, it's a punishment, okay?
Right.
It's a denigration, okay? As opposed to, well, understanding what the woman is an expression of what she feels, understanding that, appreciating it for what he is, or what it is, but the man's still expressing a different point of view. And that's how I think a couple can really grow. It's really the appreciation and even love of the difference, okay? But what we're talking about here is somebody who is so defective that when there is difference, they presume that they are wrong, and then they submit, okay? And a lot of women, as you know, are in relationships like that, and there is no way on this earth anybody can be happy in a relationship like that, because who they are is denied entrance into the world. And the farther away you live from who you are, the more unhappy you're going to be.
And if you start from your beginnings feeling terrible about yourself, it's just painfully, I mean, just overwhelmingly amplified in a bad relationship as an adult.
It absolutely is. And what happens is, and you see this all the time clinically, is you get a kind of vicious cycle. Or because the woman feels bad about herself, if she's told that she's wrong, she'll believe she's wrong. And that will fortify her belief there's something wrong with her because look at the response she got, right? And then she won't express what she feels, okay? And so then the man will take over, and then the woman feels, of course, everything she feels or would do would be wrong, okay? Mm-hmm. And so you get that kind of vicious cycle that amplifies that pattern, and then the woman gets stuck, okay? And then finally, often there is some symptomatic expression of that, an affair, an expression of rage, an eating disorder, something that
medical
they'll come to
illness.
Therapy for. A medical illness.
Medical illness. Cancers,
right.
Neurological problems,
somatic complaints.
Sclerosis. Oh, it just goes on and
goes
on.
Goes on and on, right.
Depression.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they will come into therapy for, the depression or the symptom of whatever it is. And then it's our job as therapists to trace that back to the burial of the self. And what the woman doesn't realize is that unless she's able to exercise who she is and be able to live her life according to what she feels, she's always going to have some symptom or other. It's
right.
going to be depression or a somatic symptom of some sort.
Mm. Well, as you know, the mission of our show is to help women access genuine happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Let's imagine that at this very moment, there is a listener who suffers greatly from feeling defective.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to, if I may, quote again from Transcending the Self, and
sure.
this is on, thank you, on mm-hmm. page 199, and mm-hmm. I quote, "Hidden beneath the narcissistic defense is not simply a feeling of defect, but also a potential self that
right.
has not been allowed direct expression,"
right.
end quote. As many of our listeners know, Dr. Barbara's Enchanted Self and My Woman You Were Born to Be elaborate upon this potential self. From your perspective, Dr. Summers, what suggestions have you to help a woman relieve her unbearable defective self tension, to free her to step into her potential mm-hmm. self and
okay.
and thereby access authentic, lasting happiness?
Well, the first thing I want to say is I'm sorry that we're running so much out of time
yes,
here because
we are.
I could talk for another 20 minutes easily on that question. I wish I could have more time to go into it more fully, but just in what we have maybe 1 minute left, what I can say is try to be as aware as you can of what you feel. Try to move your focus away from what other people think. What are other people, how are other people going to react? And say, okay, irrespective of how anyone else reacts or what anyone else thinks, what do I feel? What do I think? Okay? To make yourself aware, as aware as you can of what you think, and then think about, or feel, and then think about how you can then translate that into what you would do. Now, we can't all do everything we want, of course. We always have to negotiate with the realities of the world. But what part of what you feel and what you think can then become the guideline for your behavior? How can you translate that? What can you articulate that? Can you act on that in some way? Because my main message here to women who feel a defective self is that the way you feel a stronger, healthier, more robust sense of self is to act on what you feel, to use your feelings, use your thoughts, your values, what you believe, okay, your authenticity as the guideline for your behavior. The more authentic you can become, the happier you're going to be.
Amen. Oh, thank you, Dr. Summers.
Well, you're quite welcome. I'm sorry we have so little time. I would like to talk more about this. But
well, we'd love to prevail upon you to come back in the near future. Thank you.
I would love to do that if we can.
Yes. So for those listeners who have not yet tuned in to Dr. Summers' earlier Happiness for Women Only interview, you may find it in the archives at August 3rd, 2007. Dr. Summers' website is www.franksummersphd.com, where you can find links to his books, and you can also order his books directly from Analytic Press by phoning 1-800-9-BOOKS-9. Thanks to Dr. Barbara Becker-Holstein, who created and sustains Happiness for Women Only. Her website is www.enchantedself.com. Thanks also to Lillian Caldwell, our producer and owner of Passionate Internet Voices Radio. Till next time, I'm Martha Trowbridge. Thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for listening to Passionate Internet Voices Radio Talk. You have just listened to Martha Trobil and Happiness for Women Only. And if you enjoyed today's presentation, you can always hear it again by going back to http://internetvoicesradio.com. If you want our transcript of today's program, again, go back to http://internetvoicesradio.com. Click on Daily Information. Scroll down the page until you come to Deb Harris's name, where her email is located. Copy and paste that. Put in today's date, then put in the time, then put in Martha's name, and Deb will take great care of you. PIVTR, whether providing you with the advice of experts or giving a voice to the average person who would not otherwise be heard. PIVTR emphasizes quality and enriching programs for our listeners' enjoyment. And before you go away and stray for the day, I would like to leave you with this one thing by Natalia Ginsburg, who said, "When I write stories, I am like someone who is in her own country, walking along streets that she has known since she was a child, between walls and trees that are hers." Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a grand weekend, and we hope to see you again soon. Thank you, and remember, keep listening.